Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Members' Day 2007, which is a rather special one in that we have one of our own members who on this very day, the publication date of her book, is here to present it, which I think is tremendous. The order of proceedings will be... Anne will kick off by presenting her book, Making God, A New Materialist Theory of the Person. Then two of our most distinguished members, Charles Brown and Alan Bailey, will make their critiques and comments on different aspects of what a book that in fact covers a huge amount of ground, followed again by Anne exercising her right of reply. And then after that, in the last section, everybody will have their chance to make their own comments and queries on what's gone on in the panel discussion. Before I, as it were, formally introduce Anne, two things. First, thank yous. I'd like to thank Jules Rees, who is a very busy man, being both webmaster and editor of the Review for the Society, for organising this event. And I'd like to thank Eileen too, who has done, as usual, our indefatigable secretary and treasurer, a tremendous amount of work in making today happen. I'd also like to welcome here today Anthony Freeman, who is proprietor of Imprint Academic, the publishers who have published Anne's book and also a great number of titles by very eminent people in academia. The leaflet gave you all the opportunity to order books on the Imprint Academia list and at a 20% discount. And during the coffee breaks and so on, if you took advantage of that, you can see Anthony Freeman at the back of the lecture hall during the breaks and pay him for the books. Anthony, I wonder if you just stand up so everybody knows who you are.
So can I hold just a...
Yep.
There are quite a lot of copies of the catalogue there, and I bought a selection of books, but already quite a lot of those have gone. Any book from our catalogue ordered and paid for today, you will get the conference discount on, and I'll send it to you tomorrow morning when I get home. So do feel free to order anything from the catalogue, whether or not it's here today. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Now to Anne and Making God. Hang on a second. Anne is the mother of three grown-up children whom she raised within an otherwise full-time career as a psychologist. In the few years since she retired, she has devoted herself to writing Making God, but it had its origins much earlier. As she says, the ideas which have fed it have been accumulated across almost a lifetime. I think from the book, one thing we already suspected about Anne is wholly reinforced, just how knowledgeable she is and how incredibly well read in psychology, philosophy, theology, science generally, and in the wider field of literature. Her ideas are fascinating, many of them startling, and some of them so startling as to obviously cause a lot of controversy, which is what I hope today is partly about, but all of them are explained in meticulous detail in the book. Anne Long, psychologist, philosopher, author, will you please present your book?
Thank you for that lovely introduction. I have got a device here which I can turn on if the people at the back can't hear. Can you hear me at the moment?
Yeah.
Okay, I'll turn it on if there are any grumblings apparent in the back row, but I can't see you, so that's an okay. First of all, let me say how very chuffed I am that the members, that the society should have made it possible for me to take part in this occasion. So chuffed that if I'm not careful, I'll spend too much time being chuffed. I won't get around to what I've got to say. And given the book is 428 pages long, and I've only got, I think, 50 minutes, I think I'd better launch straight in. But you know what I'm chuffed. Right. So, it's a book about persons, and I'm trying to answer not the very famous question, who do you say that I am, but the much less frequently asked question, what do you say that I is? And if your first question would have been, why persons, why not people? That's just because person is more or less a technical term, I suppose, in psychology. So persons is its plural of choice. It's my plural of choice, anyway. Now, as Frank said, until my retirement a few years ago, I spent most of my life teaching psychology. But slowly, over the years of doing so, I realised that quite literally, I didn't know what I was talking about. Every ology needs an object of study. My ology was supposed to be studying the psyche. And it's something that's gone under lots of different names across its history. It's been soul, spirit, mind, subject, agent, person, all these sorts of things. And I. And I registered that when I was thinking about any of them, I didn't know what they were. And I've been teaching this subject for a large number of years, and it got me somewhat embarrassed that I didn't know what any of them were. And this is the way I put it, first to myself, and then to... Excuse me, someone got really fed up with me doing this. I used to say, okay, I is an entity which has a body, for I exercise it, don't I? And then I would stride across the platform. I exercise it. Yes, I said. Then, I is something which changes, it has a mind, which it changes. I change it. Where I was before. Haven't we there got, I said, an impossible trinity? What you've got there is my body, my mind, and me. What's this third thing? And I thought of it as a trinity even more difficult to explain than the original. How do you make sense of this threesomeness? So I determined that if it was the last thing I did, I was going to try and answer that question, what on earth is this I thing that I've been talking about for all these years? And given the amount of time it's taken, it perhaps will be the last thing that I do. Anyway, given the constraints of time, although it will leave much unsaid, a lot unsaid, I'm going to try to make 4 points only on the book's content this morning, and they're outlined for you in your handout, and even that might turn out to be a bit too ambitious. I'm going to try dealing with 2 existences, 2 boundaries, 2 gods, and 2 consequences. Those are the 4 points that I'm going to try to deal with. So, first of all, 2 existences. Yes, there's loads of stuff I'm looking at here. Sorry, pause for that person. If you're also going to need this glossary, which I'm going to refer to now. Is there anybody who hasn't got this? This? Does that mean we're going to refer to this? I'm going to refer to this. Okay. Got that? It's a bit rude, but I'm going to press on while you're being given those because the time is really very tight. So, on the first point, two existences. Can you turn to the chart which is at the back of the glossary? It's on page 29. What I've got there is what I'm claiming as an outline of what I'm calling reality. And I'm suggesting the best hypothesis going, there are others, as to the nature of this reality, is that it constitutes an outsideless, closed system. So, in true 20 questions style, I find 20 questions often quite useful at helping me give me things. In true 20 questions style, if a thing isn't animal, vegetable, mineral, abstract, or some combination of the four, it isn't. It doesn't exist. But this isn't, what I found is that this is not an ontological restriction. This is not something which cuts down the number of things which you can say exist. Far from that, it's a very capacious concept of existence. Because what it means, to modify a bit what I've just said, what it means is that any entity which is proposed, like let's say a unicorn, comes into existence simply by being proposed. And it comes into existence as a proposed entity. It's in the abstract category. So if I say that that's the way in which I'm thinking of reality, it's not a flipped closed thing, it's quite a generous thing. Like it includes everything you can think of and then a few more. Now, I'm also suggesting that this reality thing has two ways of existing. And sticking again to the useful 20 questions formula, its constituents are either animal, vegetable, and mineral material things, or they're abstract happenings. In short, I'm a materialist. Now, to accommodate E equals MC squared and all those happenings, of course my material things are matter of the matter in motion variety, the variety that Galileo, I suppose, established for us. But that alters nothing. I'm a materialist. And let me register something important about that right at the outset. When I first started coming to Ruley House philosophy, I was a bit thrown by constant references to the physics of whatever we were talking about. Now, in psychology, we used to call this, nodding in the direction of Freud, we used to call this physics envy. And it was something that to guard against, not embrace. You guarded against it, you didn't embrace it. So, let me just point out here on this theory that I'm calling materialism. I'm calling materialism a theory, there'll be a question about that. Materialism is not matterism. I don't think it's an accident that we call this position materialism, not matterism. Because whatever physics is going to tell us that matter is, that explanation will have to be answerable to 114 distinct elements with different properties which combine in different ways and compounds and mixtures, etc., etc., to chemistry. Whatever physics tells us matter is, it's going to have to be answerable to that reality. And for the chemistry that matters a lot to the subjects under discussion here, for an example, if you look at the electrical transmission down axons and dendrites of the human nervous system, that goes on via a leakage of ions across the membrane of sodium and potassium. It's a sodium-potassium pump mechanism. It wouldn't work if it wasn't sodium and potassium, but, I don't know, rubidium and something or other. In other words, the chemistry is specific. And similarly with the synapses of the system, the chemical messages passed across the synapses use particular transmitters, acetylcholine, for example. The system wouldn't work if what you had was methanoic acid or whiskey or something. It's got to be those chemical material things put restrictions upon and enablements for whatever it is that this system can do. So back then to my two existences, material things and happenings. I've said I'm not a materialist, I'm a materialist. both, I'm claiming, are in evidence at all three levels of reality as it's outlined on the chart. In a pretty obvious sense, oxygen is a material thing and rosting is a happening at the level of the universe. Level of the biosphere, tigers are material things and digestion is a happening. And at the level of the world, which might be more contentious, tables are material things and thinking is a happening. Happenings always happen in and through material things. Nobody's ever caught a happening which wasn't happening in and through a material thing. So, to make a contentious point, the so-called mental happenings, or mental events, can't be categorized as happenings taking place in the mind, because the mind is not a material thing. I mean, most folk are happy that substance dualism has gone. Minds, in fact, are happenings in themselves. They are the happenings. You can't have happenings in happenings. So I'm suggesting that minds are happenings taking place in human brains. They're what brains do. Brains mind. And that's the... Well, it's almost the end of the first point that I want to make, two existences, material things and happenings. But just to conclude that section, I want also to say that as long as an entity can be categorised as either a material thing or a happening, and I'm claiming that all entities can be so classified, then that entity is amenable to scientific investigation. As long as it's a material thing or a happening, everything's a material thing or a happening, therefore everything's amenable to scientific investigation. Now, it seems to me a curious volte-face goes on when we're thinking about science. Almost everybody, when pressed, will say, oh, of course, science is a method. Science is a way of studying things. Science isn't physics or chemistry, it's a method. But then, when you go on in further into the discussion, that tends to get forgotten, that it's a method. And people, instead of identifying science with the application of a particular method to the study of whatever you're studying, we start thinking about it in an old-fashioned way as the study of some things, but not other things. Now I'm saying, the claim I'm making is everything can be studied scientifically. Or, of course, unscientifically. I mean, I think a lot of the stuff that's going on in current cosmology, for example, is thoroughly unscientific. And you can't call it scientific. You know, it isn't a science because cosmology is a science. Because science is a method. Okay, that's the end of the first point. Two existences, material things and happenings. Now, to two boundaries, still with the chart that you started with. The first boundary is that between the biosphere and the world. And the second, this time within the world, is that between what I'm calling I am persons and I is a person. And what I want to do with this second point is to try to make clear why those two boundaries are so important to the case that I want to make. Traditionally, the boundary between the biosphere and the world has been marked by both religious and rational criteria, I suppose. Sometimes one, sometimes the other, sometimes an attempt to amalgamate the two. In short, if you think about humans have been thought to be different from all other animals in three different ways. Well, no doubt there's some more, but these three main ways. One, because they're made in the image of God with immortal souls. So that has been the traditional religious conception which divides what humans are from the biosphere. And that's the argument, for example, from Christianity. Another way is to say, because humans are the only rational animals, and that comes, I suppose, originally from Greek philosophy, but it's very, very widespread as a way of saying what makes us different from all the rest. And thirdly, some mixture of the two. There were lots of attempts, particularly medieval attempts, to mesh together those two traditions and to come out with, I suppose, what's a third and separate position. But in all of them, no, that's not true. In almost all of them, I can think of a few where it's not true, but in almost all of those attempts, there has free will has played an important role. So the human animals made in the image of God, well, they are free to choose, especially, of course, to choose between good and evil. That's what makes us different from donkeys or whatever. But in also the Greek tradition, the rational animals tradition, after rational deliberation, the rational animal was supposed to be free to decide. Again, to decide between, well, to decide whether to have coffee or tea, but I mean to decide also everything, to decide in particular what's right and what's wrong. But for some time now, as we're all aware, such traditional criteria as these have been coming under increasing pressure. And I'm going to suggest that they're coming under increasing pressure from several different sources. And some of the sources are themselves mutually antagonistic. It's not a united front. There are a whole host of different challenges to those positions. So I'm going to just indicate, just by listing them really, five of those challenges. First of all, post the scientific revolution, and by that I mean 16th to 17th century scientific revolution, everything came increasingly to appear caused and determined. I've got a little note in my notes here to say, do mention quantum mechanics and why that isn't a problem, but I'm going to leave it. And that somebody will no doubt ask in when we get to questions. Secondly, post-Darwin, human animals have come to look less and less different from all their animal kin. So there's another challenge. Three, post the death of God, Nietzsche's proclamation of the death of God, philosophies, I would argue, has become less and less enamoured of being found in bed with theology, and therefore it has shifted across to identify much more fully with science, perhaps you could say Quine-led, but not only there. And that puts a pressure on this boundary. Fourth, since Crick, Watson, the Human Genome Project, it's not only that humans are looking less and less different from other animals, it's that when you've got the Human Genome Project in place and you look at the results, we're looking less and less different from parrots, sort of thing. And that's putting another pressure on this boundary. Fifthly, the decline of psychology as an arts subject, which is in a massive decline, and its presentation instead in all academic places as a science subject, means that we've now got psychology, cognitive science, neuroscience, all three related but distinctly different. There are different traditions within them. We used to have psychology as basically an arts discipline, and that's putting pressure on this boundary. And sixthly and lastly, a pressure which maybe not everybody in the room would recognise, but I think is quite important. A pressure being put on that boundary as a result of the decline of Marxism. Marxism, I think, offered the most systematic, that we've so far had, underpinning of what are wrongly called, I think, the social sciences. And with its decline, what's happened is an alternative underpinning, based mainly in evolutionary psychology, sociobiology, has taken its place. And that puts another pressure on that boundary. So, what are we to do about that? Are we to say, okay, throw up our hands, we're just clever animals, that's all there is to it, an end of all those utopian dreams about being able to be something else? Now, the answer, I argue, on that one is twofold. First, to insist upon the maintenance of the boundary. Though, as I'll go in... Sorry, Marianne.
I didn't hear that.
To insist upon the maintenance of that boundary. There is a real difference between persons and all people and all the rest. Though, as I'll go to show and say in a minute, move it by almost 3 million years, not going into detail. That is, continue to maintain that humans are special, indeed so special as to be the source of a whole new and third level of reality called the world. We're special, all right. But second, to recognise that in the face of the sorts of scientific advances I've been talking about, old defences of that boundary, now by that I mean those based in idealism, dualism, things which produce concepts like free will and rational animals, those sorts of concepts are going to have to go. If that boundary is to be maintained, those concepts are going to have to go. If the specialness of humans is going to be successfully defended and taken scientifically seriously, that defence is going to have to be mounted using criteria, not religious, but scientific, not dualist, but monist, not idealist, but materialist. That's the position that the book adopts. So how can that be done? Or even, can it be done? Is it possible to do that? Now I think it's important to stress here that there can be no fudging on this issue. Human is a very difficult word, I have found in my thinking, and I'm sure a lot of people have, to think with. It's a dodgy word to think with. Human animals are to be found clearly on the biosphere side of this boundary. If something different, which is human, is to be found on the world side, indeed constituting the world side, as I said, it has to be something different but equally scientifically respectable. And if there is no such something, if we can't find that, then we do have to say, I think, to the evolutionary biologists, the associate biologists, and so on and so on, we do have to say, yes, hands up, we're just rather clever animals. And I think we need an answer to that, and this would be my proposal to start getting an answer. First, move the biosphere world boundary through about 2.9 million years, roughly speaking, give or take a million. That is, move it nearer to today. The boundary traditionally has been at the point at which humans of one sort or another emerged. I think you get a better boundary if you move it to the point at which language emerges, which is of course much nearer to us, only 100,000 years probably at the most. So shift the boundary, but that's not cheating, that's just saying we're shifting the boundary, it makes better sense here. Second, delineate the human which constitutes the world side of that boundary, delineate that as the human person. What's on the other, what's on the world side of the boundary is not Homo sapiens, it's a human person, that's move two. And move three is find a scientific, rather than what up to now has been essentially, I think, a magical, delineation of a person. And by that, as I say, I mean materialist, monist, blah, blah, blah. Not an animal, a non-animal of any kind, not even a rational one. And my suggestion as to how we do that brings me to the second boundary, which is on your chart. Just as one planet in the universe, Earth, hosts the biosphere of species, so I'm suggesting one species in the biosphere, Homo sapiens, hosts the world of persons. Hosts is the best word I can find for it. It's not necessarily ideal, but it's the best I can do. And in the study of these things called persons, I'm suggesting this should be the protocol. First, abandon all concepts borrowed from biology. Sorry, Charles. Concepts such as life, evolution, human nature, behaviour, and the like. They're all scientifically respectable concepts, but they're in the wrong science. They're in the science of humans as animals, humans on the biosphere side of that boundary. So abandon all of those, and they won't do to study persons themselves, mainly because persons are not organisms. And all those concepts are designed for the studies, a very successful study, of organisms. So get rid of all those. Second, abandon all concepts borrowed from philosophy and theology. And that means things like souls, spirits, minds, subjects, mental events, qualia, free will, and the like. Those are all based, some of you radical enough, those are all based in idealism and dualism, and they're not scientific at all. they won't do to study persons, because persons are essentially, I'm going to argue, not magical entities. And those who study them as if they were, or study Oscars if you will, we're indulging in what I'm calling personic exceptionalism. There's this one little thing which exists on one planet, in one little part of the huge universe, which, believe it or not, contradicts all the basic laws of physics. Well, because, you know, it's Barney in a sense, isn't it? We will be wrong when it's Barney for a long time, I think. So which then are the appropriate scientific but not biological concepts to use when studying persons? Well, first we've got to recognise that all concepts sit within hypotheses. A concept belongs to a particular hypothesis. So we've got to have a hypothesis as to what we think a person is, and then look around for what are the appropriate concepts. Okay, so here's my hypothesis in three stages, so you get how it's built up. Number one, to separate it clearly from the material thing, which is a human animal, hypothesize a person not as an entity which has experience, but an entity which is experience. That's what it is. It's experience. Then, two, to separate it clearly from all other animals with nervous systems, because they all have experience as well, hypothesize it as, they all are experience as well, sorry, the language is difficult here. Hypothesize it not just as experience, but as linguistically structured experience. And that puts it just to us. And then thirdly, and this one's quite important, and I often forget it when I'm talking to people and getting to the right people, to make sure nobody thinks that you're talking about free-floating experience, which would be pretty daft, hypothesize it as the linguistically structured experience of a Homo sapiens. So you've got the host material thing in as well as the happening. So that would be that's my proposal, and with these moves in place, I think this is what emerges at the second boundary. With I am persons as those positive to have their experience, and I is persons positive to be their experience, the earlier I am stage of personic emergence can be seen as one intermediary between humans as animals and humans as fully fledged persons. If you like, it's a stage where we might call them, us actually, proto-persons. Because we're linguistic entities, so we now come into the person category. We're persons, all right, per so not, right? But being only newly emergent from our biological host, and if you want to get a sense of newly emergent, look not now but sometime at the other two charts at the back there, to get a sense of how new that is. In order to take account of that, what we need to do is to register that we are newly emergent from our biological host, and so we trail a whole lot of the characteristics of that host behind us. Okay, so if that's the hypothesis, what is to be said for such a hypothesis? What does it do for us when we're trying to think in these areas? Well, I suggest we try these five things for starters, five things that it does for us. First, it allows us unambiguously to separate out a Homo sapiens from a person. Suppose one of you was to leave this lecture hall, go on the robot, lose two legs, it's a bit of a gruesome example, but it occurs, you would be a lesser Homo sapiens by two of your limbs, by some number of kilograms, by some number of capacities. You wouldn't be able to hopscotch, might be difficult. But would anybody accept, nobody in this room I presume would accept, that thereby you were a lesser person? This thing person is real, all right. I think everybody knows it's real, all right. But the problem is, how are we trying to identify it? And at first approximation, that I think is quite helpful really, we might settle on such things as it being a voice. By that I mean a say in the human conversation, a voice, a say in the human conversation. And that doesn't mean to say that if you lost your voice you wouldn't be such a person, because you use then other channels to get your say into the human conversation. So that's its first advantage. Its second advantage, this is the advantage of the hypothesis, is it allows us to shed what I think are really obfuscating ideas about persons having properties. Maybe lots of people have said it, I encountered it in Anthony Flew, but probably lots of people have pointed out that the whole case for things having properties is a bit suspicious. As Anthony Flew put it, as I remember, he suggested that means that if a thing was stripped one by one of all its properties, with that notion of the thing, whatever it was, there it would be left, propertyless. Stripped of all its properties, and there it is, propertyless. And Flew says that's bummy, and I think he's probably right. So when a person becomes that which is experience, rather than that which has experience, or has experience as one of its properties, you've got that problem. And when you have it as has experience, sorry, when you have it as is experience, you lose that problem, and things called subjects and agents can disappear because they can disappear because essentially they have been characters in a story rather than concepts in an explanation. They've been characters in a story rather akin to, say, the character Mother Nature as that entity which does the selecting in natural selection. We all know there isn't such a character. But that's the story character. Or the character, the it in sentences like, it is raining. Subjects and agents disappear as those sorts of things. They're chimera, a lot of them, often. So thirdly, it allows a return to what the founders of what I think are misnamed social sciences, perhaps particularly those working in anthropology, I've only recently become really aware of that, were trying to make foundational concerning persons. Perhaps the best known formulation of their position comes from 1845, from a document called Theses on Feuerbach. Written, if Radio 4's audience for in our time is anything to go by, written by Britain's favourite philosopher. There are 11 of these theses, the 11th being the famous one that everybody knows. Philosophers have only interpreted the world, the problem is to change it. Well, this one that I'm talking about is the 6th of the 11 theses on Feuerbach, and it's the one that sees persons, he says individuals, but in the context, you know, he's talking about persons. It sees persons as ensembles of social relations. An ensemble of social relations is not an organism of any sort. Now, according to my hypothesis, an even better formulation would have been an ensemble of linguistic relations, but it's the sort of answer which is on the right track. And there are lots of those sorts of answers, particularly in anthropology. Recently, I've been finding them in Radcliffe Brown, in Maya Forte's, to some extent in Edmund Leach. Formulations of what a person is on that sort of a line. And that satisfies this hypothesis will accommodate that sort of explanation. As it will also accommodate another German, Wilhelm Wundt, who often goes down as the founder of scientific psychology. He opened the first psychological laboratory in 1879 in Leipzig. And when he was asked what the subject matter of his science was, he replied, Erfahrungswissenschaft, which means the science of experience. And an ensemble of linguistic relations approach to what a person is answers very nicely that if persons are linguistically structured experience, it would suit his project fine. Fourthly, it turns a person into an entity existing in time, a durational entity, rather than in space, an extensional entity. And when turning later to the significance of equality to my hypothesis, that durationalness will be quite important. In parenthesis, if there's anybody here just sitting aching to say But don't you know we live in space-time these days? Space-time, as I understand it, is a mathematical formalism. It's excruciatingly valuable if you're studying the nature of the universe, but it's of absolutely no consequence if you bump into a bus stop because it's in space, but are nonetheless able to catch the bus because you reached it in time. There is a difference. Okay, so fifthly and lastly, it turns persons into entities just as caused but differently caused, just as determined but differently determined as all the other organic entities on the biosphere. And I did try to spell that out, but I've just noticed the time. When did I start? 10 past. Okay. I think I won't spell that out. It can come out perhaps in a question if necessary. Now, a hypothesis which delivers at this level is not to be sniffed at, just for a handful of things. It is with a hubris problem, the momentous hubris problem of Hasonic exceptionalism. It deals with the interface problem. How does a determinate and an indeterminate system interface the one with the other? If you haven't got an indeterminate system, you haven't got the problem. It deals with the blaming problem. What on earth is the very dubious morality of blaming people for things that they did which they could not otherwise do? So I think that hypothesis offers quite a lot, and what I do in the bulk of, not quite half of the book, is to I explore that hypothesis. What I do is I take 35 philosophical problems as my specimens, problems such as those like is and ought, free will and determinism, reasons and causes, all those. I take them as specimens. I remove from them a formulation of an I, which is an I am, something that has its experience. I insert into them a formulation of an I as an I is, something that is experienced. And then I argue that the result is the solving or dissolving of the problem concerned. But time being what it is, I'm not going to go into any of all that. And if you want to look at how that works out, I shall say there's only once, and you need to buy the book. So the third thing, I forgot a bit now. Third thing, two gods. In order to know who he is dealing with, Moses, as I'm sure everybody knows, called into the burning bush and asked God to show himself. declining to be so examined, the reluctant deity, elusive, interestingly enough, as anything other than a voice, replied with what is now known as the great tautology. He said, out of his burning bush, I am that I am. And in this third point, I want to turn my attention to that I am that I am God, made, as I argue, in their own image by his I am creators. Among many another, Freud identified three functions as those that have been fulfilled by the idea of a monotheistic God. It gave us a story about the origins of working of the universe, a story about the origins and workings of life, and a story about what it means to be good. And Freud said, and others have said much the same, that of the three, the first and second are now pretty well secured in other places, not as stories but as explanations in the physical sciences and the biological sciences. But that third, what does it mean to be good, isn't really well secured anywhere. And the whole struggle that philosophers have had for as long as, I don't know what time span to put on it, to try to say something definitive, useful, helpful even, about what is the good, is another book all in itself. It used to be, in the past, if you asked, what is it to do good, the answer would be, it's to do the will of God. And there would be plenty of people around to tell you that they knew what that will was, and there were ways they had of making you do it as well. Now, anthropologists point out that this sort of monotheistic God emerged at just that historical moment when human groups became too large simply to be known individually to the leader of the group. There's a bit of research that comes out of Liverpool University, which says that number might be 150, which is a bit specific, but never mind. When a group becomes too large to know each member of it individually, then you get the emergence of the I am that I am sort of God. And it's as though little I ams, these are people seeing themselves as, positing themselves as, outside the world, because they are something outside the world, observing it, doing things to it or not doing things to it as their free will determines, outside the world, over against the world, uncaused causes, prime movers. They saw themselves that way. And so they created a great big version of themselves, which was an outside the world, over against the world, uncaused causer and prime mover. It was as though each of those persons, as in most of them, we have to imagine, it was as though each of those persons were saying to the little platoon over which they had some dominion, look, maybe I can't see what you're up to and know what you're up to, but he can, so watch it. And you got an I am as I am sort of God. Now what that God did was it provided an unquestionable single source for universal values. And what a source! I mean, this wasn't just any old person. This was a person from the University of Commons. This was somebody who was immortal, invisible, ineffable, Lord of Lords, King of Kings, all-knowing, all-powerful, and all-good. Well, beat that for a source of universal value if you can. And we couldn't. We hadn't been able to for many centuries, for millennia. The only way to rebel against that as a source of universal value was not to question him directly, for he was he, but instead to question the reliability of his translators, the people who on earth were telling us, we know what God wills and it's this, so let's do it. So we've done some of that, but the questioning of the very I am that I am itself has been much harder to come by. Now what I'm arguing is that apart from their maximally different sizes, the I am creator and the I am that I am created God, those are the same phenomenon. They are precisely the same phenomenon. The function of the I of an I am person is to provide an ultimate and unquestionable explanation which will not in its turn need explaining. The book stops, the explanation book, if you like, stops here. An I am is not mediated, it's a centre. It's a centre out from which it initiates as a free-willing agent. It originates as an autonomous creator. Well, just do the comparison. I am that I am. What is that I am that I am? It's not mediated. It's a centre from which it initiates as a free-willing agent. It makes a universe of our own world. It originates as an autonomous creator. There's no need to ask in either case what this I am is. Descartes is very clear when talking about the I am, which is the human person, in spelling out there's no need to ask what is I, because it is essentially ineffable. Well, you get to the I am that I am God, there is no need to ask what is I am that I am. It's essentially ineffable. There's a modern theologian, and I can't remember his name, and Anthony might know it, who is very critical of this approach, which says there are some things which are ineffable. He says, you know, we've got to try and say what they are. And he refers to these processes. We've got to F the ineffable, he says. It's a brilliant way of putting it, I think. Effing the ineffable, yes. Now, I think it's this role of I, as it's outside the world, over against the position, which points to the utter incoherence, which Marianne and I have exchanged opinions on many times, the utter incoherence of the way in which philosophy separates ontology from epistemology. That separation makes no sense. Once you understand that this I is posited as being outside the world, and all eyes are inside the world, they're part of the ontology. All this is put much more clearly in chapter 11 in the book, which some people have questioned, Alan questioned it a bit. I think of chapter 11, if you read it, as I think of it as a conceit. A conceit in the sort of literary sense of an elaborate metaphor, whereby what you're doing, or what I'm doing in chapter 11, is comparing an I am God as I first outlined it, with an I is alternative, which is not an alternative Great Big Daddy, which I think was what Alan was worried about, but the alternative which argues that the only view from nowhere, which is what God was supposed to provide for us, is in fact the view from everywhere. Nowhere doesn't exist. The only view from nowhere could realistically be the view from everywhere. And I'm arguing in the last section of what I have to say, which is about in time, that the view from everywhere amounts to the view from all free and equal persons. Okay, lastly then, two consequences of all this. Of course I know that a sophisticated audience like this one will not be mistaking materialism as a philosophical concept, working counter to idealism, will not be mistaking that for materialism in its pejorative sense of thinking that nothing much, thinking that the only things which matter are material things that you can accumulate and values don't matter. Of course, this audience will not be doing that. But nonetheless, I do think that there is often a seepage across that the relationship between those two concepts, such that materialism is seen as somehow something not really quite respectable. I mean, they're dodgy, these people. They're a bit hard-nosed, and they don't know about spirits, and they don't know about literature, and they don't know about music. So the reason for finishing up with my two consequences is to try to counter such a seepage. So let me conclude, therefore, with equality and love. Human animals are constituents of the biosphere. As a consequence of evolution, their struggle is the struggle to live, as is the struggle of all the other members of the biosphere, the struggle to live. And human animals are as capable and have been as capable of being read in tooth and hand as all the rest of them have been capable of being read in tooth and claw. That's part of the evolutionary process. But by contrast, human persons are constituents of the world. And what I'm arguing is that if you're a constituent of the world, then it's not evolution which matters, because you're not an organism. It's something called development which takes over. Development via language use of the consciousness which ushers in both self and other. There's me and there's all those others who seem to be a bit like me. And the struggle of those sorts of things, persons, is not the struggle to live, the book is arguing, it's the struggle to love. Now, in the social sciences, it was Eric Fromm who provided one of the best known, certainly, and certainly one of the most frequently used ideas as to what love is in his little book, The Art of Loving. And he thought of it as love is actively to pursue the well-being of the loved. No daffodil can do it, no tiger can do it. I'd stick my neck out and say no chimp can do it. Actively to pursue the well-being of the loved. And who are the loved? They are those of the ilk of the lovers, those who are doing the loving, which those lovers can recognize as such. That's who they are. And I'm arguing in the book that just as it was inevitable that once living things existed, evolution would occur, so it was equally inevitable that once loving things existed, once there was a glimmering of the consciousness that there's me here and there's some other people out there who look like they might be a bit like me, once that emerged, once loving things existed, development was also as inevitable as evolution. It's a different process. I will contest that with Charles for as long as long. It's a different process. But it's as inevitable. That's what I'm arguing. Evolution pits one living thing against other living things in the struggle to live, and just as inevitably, development recruits one loving thing for other loving things in the cooperative struggle to love. And in the book I'm positing I am persons as those who are earlier stages of this, developmentally earlier stages of this process, Earlier in two senses, I suppose. Earlier in the sense of there are fewer of their own kind whom they recognise as those it's appropriate from to see as their own kind to love. And eventually, finishing up at the stage where all other persons, literally all other persons, are seen as those whom it's appropriate that they love. So that's the developmental shift from I am to I is. I'm very conscious of running out of time here. I'm going a bit too fast. But anyway, I'll have to go a bit too fast.
10 minutes.
Sorry?
10 minutes.
Are we having any questions? Okay, slow down.
It's 10 past.
Yes, so I know, but we want to give questions. Yeah, okay. Now, as that recognition develops then, that all other persons are fall under Fromm's idea of actively pursuing the well-being of the love. What the book argues is that in order to do that, in order to make sense of that and to live that, equality, that which Dworkin calls the sovereign virtue, equality is absolutely basic to that. You can't love other people if at the same time you want to have more than they do, be more successful than they do, look after your own little platoon. You can't. What you're doing is you're extending the possibilities each time you bring more people into your little platoon and it gets bigger and bigger. But there are always some people who are outside. I should say, for Jean here, who is the president, secretary of the John McMurray Society, he is a philosopher who wonderfully gets hold of this. You know, if you want to read somebody who understands that process, read John McMurray. And because it's cooperation which characterises persons, it's competition which characterises animals, including human animals, it's cooperation which characterises persons. Because that's what it is, cooperation between persons is over and over and over again vitiated by inequalities. In a sense, we all know it in our personal relationships, like relationships between nations. I'm not saying anything very staggering. But particularly, so the book argues, the particular equality which matters most, maybe because it underpins all the others, I think, is inequality of wealth and income. And for a tiny, tiny, but I think powerful example, earlier on I said, conceiving of a person as durational rather than spatial would have an impact on thinking about equality. Well, here's a tiny little way in which it works. Consider a person spending an hour of her or his time driving a bus, and a person spending an hour of her or his time lecturing to some students, and a person spending an hour of her or his time running a government, if that makes sense. Each is making the same contribution. What is that same contribution? They are contributing 1 hour of their durational personness. That's what they are contributing. 1 hour of their durational personness. And what the book argues is that any economic system, and it's all economic systems that have so far existed, any economic system which results in a distribution of goodies which does not respect that, which creates the sort of non-loving inequalities characteristic of capitalism, for example, is an economic system which does not respect personhood, personness. Cooperation is that which characterizes the sonic development. Cooperation can only become complete when it's the cooperation of equals. Only in a situation involving the cooperation of equals can interest be controlled for. Read Habermas struggling to make sense of what he calls an ideal speech situation. And he says, well, we're making decisions, collective decisions, we've got an ideal speech situation. What's that? Well, we've all got to assume that we are in this discussion without any differential interests.
Or Rawls, the early Rawls were saying the same thing, or similar thing. But then they cop out, because I think, they cop out because they argue that it doesn't have to be for real. You don't actually have to have a situation where all the interlocutors are equal, and you have to just be, just assume it in your discussions. And of course, that's positing a person as an I am thing that is capable of doing that, which I'm arguing it isn't. So it's only in a situation involving the cooperation of equals that interest can be controlled for, and thus the good, which is not the will of God, but the will of three equal persons, be made. You have to make it. It's called making love, and what persons are all about. That's what the book argues. Okay, thanks.
We've got just 5 minutes for questions.
Do you want me up there or?
Questions? Yes.
It's probably an entry one, your first five examples. How do I plan in the next 10 minutes what I'm going to do? I mean, you just pointed out I can't step outside the situation and say I'm not my experience, and I'm confused about my future experience. I mean, am I doing something really simple, or is there a very easy way to do it top down?
Well, I wouldn't try to knock it down. I can't see where the voice is coming from, sorry. Oh, right, okay. How do I plan the next 10 minutes? I remember when I was first coming up with these sorts of ideas, people used to say to me, and I was very much involved in left politics, people used to say to me, but Anne, if all this is going to happen anyway, why on earth do you have to run around trying to make it happen? I mean, why don't you sit back and focus on it? It got happen anyway. And I used to try out all sorts of various answers to that, and it didn't all work particularly well. And so eventually I registered that the most appropriate answer is, what is inevitable is that people who are the sort of experience that I am, that's not of course me, and lots of other people, people who are that experience will inevitably do that. So if you're, wherever the hand was, if you're a planner, it means that your linguistically structured experience for the last however many years it's been is such that that's what you will do. You will plan other people, like my youngest son, who is supposed to be here, but that's him. Oh, he is. Will not plan and will be spontaneous. And why will there be the difference between people on that score? Not because one's free willing and another isn't, not because one's got more staying power than another, not because one, not for those reasons, but simply because they are. Not they have, they are different experience, and therefore they will differentially do the one or the other. Perhaps I should add there that one problem with that formulation, which has been pointed out to me, is that, but what about the possibility of doing nothing? Now I think the answer is that it's not possible to do nothing. Biologists separate out human animals from animals and plants, not human animals, animals and plants, with three criteria, no photosynthesis, a blastula stage in their development, which doesn't matter. And the third characteristic is directed movement. Once you've got a nervous system, which is related to an outside world, you can't not do things unless you're dead. So you're going to do something, and what it is that determines what you do, whether you plan or you don't plan, is the consequence of your experiential history. That's what you are, your experiential history.
Okay. Time for no more questions, I'm afraid, at this stage. We'll have to wait until our last session. Could you try and get back by 11:35, please? Copy that. And Anne, thank you very much. Thank you.